Well, there's a true story about a Christian prison governor who was preaching one morning on the Ten Commandments to the inmates in the prison chapel, and he was challenged after the sermon by some inmates who came up to him and said, "This is totally irrelevant. No one's interested in the Ten Commandments. No one could possibly live by the Ten Commandments in the 20th century. And so the prison governor turned around and he said, "Well, okay, let's put it to the test." And he put up a notice in the prison saying, "From now on, the Ten Commandments no longer apply in this prison." And anyway, the first day went by and a man came up at the end of the day and reported that someone had stolen his pen. And the next day someone came along and said his cigarettes had mysteriously disappeared. And then at the end of the week, the governor invited one young man to tea with him. And he said to this guy, he said, "I want you to come over for tea at 5 o'clock on Friday afternoon. Don't have any supper the night before. Don't have any breakfast. It's going to be a fantastic meal. Just turn up at 5 o'clock and we'll have this great meal ready for you." So the man turned up at 5 o'clock, starving, with his mouth kind of watering with anticipation and expectation, only to find that all that was left were a few crumbs because the governor had actually started tea at 4 o'clock. And the young man was furious. He said, "We can't live like this. You're supposed to be the prison governor." And he said, "Come at 5 o'clock, and I believed you." And the prison governor turned around and said, "Ah, yes, but we're not living by the Ten Commandments." And by the end of the fortnight, by popular demand, over 2/3 of the prisoners demanded that the Ten Commandments be brought back to regulate the life of the prison. Now, it's an interesting experiment, isn't it? But it illustrates a very important truth, that truth is that no society can function properly without the Ten Commandments. Society is impossible apart from the Ten Commandments. And I think that's especially obvious in the commandment that we come to tonight in our series, the penultimate one, the ninth commandment: "You shall not give false testimony against your neighbour," Exodus chapter 20, verse 16. That's on page 74 of your Bible. No society will be able to function very long without this commandment. And this commandment has especially to do with our words. You can break all the other commandments with words. You can kill people with words, as we've seen. You can commit adultery using words. You can steal using words. But this one commandment is the one that deals explicitly with our speech. So let's take a look at it first of all. First of all, what it means practically. So that's our first heading. What does it mean practically? Then we'll look, secondly, at why it is so important. And then thirdly, we'll look at how to keep it. So what does it mean practically? Why is it so important? And then how to keep it. So first of all, what does this commandment mean practically? You shall not bear false testimony against your neighbour. What is our responsibility according to this commandment? The trouble with this, you know, have you noticed how every week the sermons have just been getting that much longer? Every week, I'm sorry about that, but the trouble with these commandments, you see, is it's not so much trying to work out what to say, but what not to say, because there's just so much in each of these short statements. They're like little windows on our computer screens where you click on them and a whole world opens up. Now, what this commandment forbids here in Exodus is false testimony, false speech, deceitful speech. But it's not just talking about blatant lies, of course, because in fact, if you go over to the book of Deuteronomy, where the Ten Commandments are repeated, the word that's used there for false testimony is a slightly different Hebrew word from the word that's here. And the word that's there in Deuteronomy literally is, "You shall not bear vain or worthless or empty testimony against your neighbour." It's not just blatant lies, you see. It's more general than that. It's worthless speech. And what's particularly important here is that this isn't just worthless speech. This isn't just deceit in some abstract vacuum. What this command is getting at is speech that's used against your neighbour. In other words, this isn't just about the form of our speech. Is it accurate or isn't it accurate? That's not really the primary issue. In fact, there are places in the Bible where inaccurate speech, even deception, seems to be condoned. And if we'll get time, I'll point you to some of those in some minutes. But the real issue here is not just the form of our speech, is it true or false, but the intention of our speech. What are we trying to do with our words? In the last 30 years or so, literary theorists have rightly come to recognise that speech is a kind of act. You do things with speech. And therefore, statements need to be evaluated not just in terms of what they say, but also in terms of what they do. What kind of speech act is it? That's the question. Is it intended to heal or is it intended to harm? Is it intended to protect the other person or is it intended to protect yourself at the expense of the other person, you see? So when it comes to this commandment, there really are two questions we need to be asking when we evaluate our speech. Firstly, is it true or false? But we can't stop there. Because it is possible to say something, it's perfectly possible to say something that might be true, accurate, and still use it against my neighbour, to deceive my neighbour, do you see? Deceit has not simply to do with the content of our words, but with the direction, the intention. So the second question is not just is this true or false, but what are these words intended to do? What kind of speech act is it? So let me give you some examples of what I think this commandment forbids. Number one, harmless lies, polite lies, kindly meant lies, euphemisms. What is a polite lie? Well, it's like something like, you know, I'd love to go, but, you know, I have something on that night. When what you really means is you wouldn't love to go at all, you'd hate to go, and you don't even know whether you've got something on that night. Right? Not only is that a lie, not only is it false, but what you are doing with that false information is you're protecting yourself. You're wanting to protect your own reputation. You're wanting to save face at the expense of the other person because you made the other person walk away thinking their party's great when it really stinks, you see. Or maybe someone gives you a present and you say, ah, another pair of socks. Just what I always wanted. When what you really mean is my drawer is overflowing with socks and can't you think of something more creative? And anyway, I hate that colour. Just a polite lie, isn't it? But once again, you're protecting yourself at the expense of the other person. Euphemisms, like that sermon was really meaty, when what you really mean is that sermon bored me to tears. By the way, just a tip, if you're bored and totally unengaged tonight, please don't put that down on one of your slips anonymously as someone did last week, because as we'll see in a minute, speaking the truth in love is also another one of these applications of this commandment. But that said, not only are there harmless lies, polite lies, euphemisms, this commandment also forbids exaggeration, word inflation. You know, word inflators, they're the people who are constantly saying, you know, everything's wonderful, everything's terrific, or everything's terrible, everything's a disaster, and eventually you have to tune them out because it's so oppressive. Happens all the time in arguments, doesn't it? You know how arguments start? It's generally because one person says to the other person, you never put the garbage out. And, of course, the other person's bound to get upset at that because they're sitting there thinking, what do you mean I never put the garbage out? I put the garbage out once on the 2nd of November 1974. And how dare you say I never put the garbage out? It's not true. Why do we exaggerate? We exaggerate to score points, don't we, so often in our arguments? But it's breaking this commandment. We can also exaggerate in order to flatter somebody. Flattery is a breach of the ninth commandment, isn't it? We can exaggerate, to manipulate a situation, to make ourselves look better than we are. Twisting the truth, manipulating the truth, giving people some of the truth, but withholding important facts either to your advantage or because you want to make the other person somehow dependent on you, or you want to control a situation, or you want to ruin their reputation. Say, for example, if you have a disagreement with someone, a falling out with someone, an argument or a disagreement, if someone hurts you, it's very easy to go off and kind of selectively report to other people the bits of truth that make you look really good and them look really bad, isn't it? That's manipulation. You're disadvantaging the other person. You're making them dependent on you. You're trampling on their dignity. You're dehumanising them, even if they have done something genuinely wrong. Well, here's another example. Let's say X, Y, and Z all know that Mr. Jones did not rob the bank. And then the police come and say, did Mr. Jones rob the bank? And X says, yes, he did. And then Y says, well, I saw him in the vicinity that night, which is true. And Z says nothing at all. Well, they've all broken the ninth commandment, haven't they? X says something that's factually inaccurate. It's a blatant lie. Y says something that's factually accurate. But it's a partial truth. It's manipulative. It's intended to mislead. And then Z says nothing at all. And that's manipulative too. It's all the same thing. It's all deception. Whether it's by untruth, partial truth, exaggeration, whether it's by silence, all those things do the same thing. They abuse the other person. I think we even need to face up to the possibility that withholding information that people need to hear about heaven and hell may be a breach of this commandment. So maybe our colleagues at work know that we're a Christian, know that we're Christians. Maybe they know we go to church. But because we're afraid of looking bad, because we want to save face, because we want to protect our reputation, we're just happy to go on in those relationships with them thinking The Christianity, you know, this Christianity stuff is good for some, but not for all. You know, it's true for some, but not true for all. I don't know. You know, is knowingly letting people carry on under that delusion a breach of this commandment? I think we need to face up to the possibility that it might be. Prejudice is breaking this commandment. Prejudging people according to their membership of a class or a culture before you've taken the time to consider that person on a case-by-case basis. Gossip. Spreading rumours about people, ruining people's reputation when you don't know the facts. Blogging. Yes, blogging. John Frame, in his book on the Christian life, when he gets to this commandment, he complains about, and I think he's speaking from personal experience, he complains about the proliferation of people who have theological axes to grind, who sort of set themselves up as internet gurus, who pontificate about all kinds of things they know nothing about, and then write people off left, right and centre and excommunicate people on their say-so alone for the whole blogging world to see, without giving the accused any defence, any protection at all. Duplicity, inconsistency, saying one thing over here and another thing over there is also breaking this commandment. Saying one thing and meaning another. Being duplicitous, it empties words of meaning, doesn't it? That's what it means to speak in vain, to speak worthless words. Political spin, advertising spin, economic spin, propaganda. Emptying words of their meaning in order to deceive, in order to get a competitive advantage, in order to win some votes, in order to sell a product or impress your boss. George Orwell, you know, writing in 1949, looking forward to the future, wrote 1984, of course. And when he wrote 1984, he was predicting the future in 1949, predicting a society in which the Ministry of Love was responsible for what? The secret police. And the Ministry of Truth was in charge of what? Propaganda. In 1949, when he wrote that, he wasn't looking just into the future. He was, of course, just reflecting on the past too. Did you know, for example, that in Hitler's Germany, the Jews were carted off to the gas chambers by the Charitable Transport Company for the Sick? That was the logo that was on the side of the vans. And the Charitable Foundation for Institutional Care collected the costs of the killings from the relatives. Vain, worthless words used to deceive. We're swimming in this, aren't we? People ought to know in our relationships where they stand with us. It shouldn't be left to guesswork. Children should know where they stand with their parents. Friends should know where they stand with their friends. Employees should know where they stand with their boss. But instead of our duplicity, our empty words, our riddles, we leave people to guess. When an outsider walks into our church and they see us singing our songs and saying our creeds, do we mean what we say? Or are they empty words? It's been said that Christians don't tell lies, they just sing hymns. Why do we sing hymns? Why do we sing if we don't mean what we sing? Why do we sing as if we mean it when we don't? Let's just keep going for a couple more minutes on this. Paul says in Ephesians, speak the truth in love. Loveless truth is not truth. So if you go to somebody and you tell them their faults, even if their faults are real, even if their faults are genuine, they need to hear about their faults. If you tell them their faults in such an abusive way or with such bad timing that they're bound to reject the truth that they need to hear because they're so offended by the way that you've addressed them, then you've been a bad witness, haven't you? A worthless witness. Because rather than using the truth to persuade and win them over, you've used the truth to harm and condemn. Loveless truth is not truth. Truthless love is not love. That's flattery. One more thing, breaking promises. Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, doesn't he, in Matthew chapter 5, he says, simply let your yes be your yes and your no be your no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one. Be a man or a woman of your word, he says. Say what you mean and mean what you say. If someone walks into the church for the first time tonight and you give them a nice, friendly welcome and you say, you know, let's catch up for a coffee sometime. Let's catch up for a meal. Make sure you do. I think it's terribly sad when I hear stories of people sometimes coming into our churches and saying, well, you were very friendly on the first visit or two, but then after that no one seemed to care. Promising one thing and then delivering another is also a breach of this commandment. I hope you can see how nuanced and profound and demanding the ninth commandment is. What this commandment requires me to do is to examine the content of my speech. Is it true or false? But not just the content, the intention of my speech, and even the intention of my lack of speech. Am I trying to help, or am I trying to harm? Am I trying to protect others, or am I trying to protect myself at the expense of others? Now, because someone's bound to us, sometimes, of course, in our foolishness, we make promises we shouldn't keep, because keeping those promises may mean that we end up disobeying God or hurting others. I mean, Herod's a good example of that, isn't he? Remember, Herod said to his wife, you know, I'll give you anything you want up until half of my kingdom. And she said, well, give me the head of John the Baptist. Whoops. Stupid promise. We're not bound to keep stupid promises that are going to hurt people or cause us to disobey God. And sometimes, even in the face of extreme evil, the Bible seems to condone the use of deception, because deception seems to be the only way that of protecting your neighbour either from serious harm or fending off an enemy who intends to do serious harm. So, for example, when Rahab tells a lie to protect the spies in the book of Joshua, or when the Israelite midwives lie to protect the babies in Egypt. But we shouldn't look at these as exceptions to the ninth commandment. I think it's better to think of them as situations where the ninth commandment doesn't apply. There's no such thing, in the end, as an exception to the rule. I mean, if a rule has an exception, then it's no longer a rule, is it? So what we have to work out is where the rule applies. And I hope we've been able to begin to see the vast range of situations where this ninth commandment does apply. But let's move on now, more briefly, to our second point. Why is this so important? Why is telling the truth, being truthful, not being a false witness, so important? Well, the thing about this commandment, as many people have noticed, is the way it's expressed in a legal or courtroom setting. See, when the commandment says, you shall not give false testimony against your neighbour, literally what it is saying is, you shall not respond to a summons against your neighbour with a false testimony, you see. In other words, unlike the previous commandments, no murder, no adultery, no stealing, which are all expressed in the abstract, this one is a little different. It doesn't say no lying, does it? It's not expressed in the abstract, it's expressed in a very concrete situation. It says, when you go into a court and the judge or whoever's there asks you to give a testimony about your neighbour, make sure you tell the truth. And we saw in our first reading from Deuteronomy what happens to the lying witness. Because if you're summoned to go into court as a witness to your neighbour who's standing over there in the courtroom dock, what does your neighbour most need from you in that situation as a witness? What do they need? They need you to tell the truth, don't they? You see, because this commandment is expressed in a very concrete situation, I think it helps underline why it is so important. Because what does an accused need the most from a witness in court? They desperately need the truth, don't they? Without the truth, the judges can't possibly make a fair decision. I mean, the truth is their freedom, literally, if they're innocent. It's Jesus, isn't it, who famously equates truth and freedom, when he says the truth will set you free in John chapter 8. And therefore, to give a false witness, to lie, to distort the truth, to withhold the truth, is to enslave your neighbour. You may literally enslave your neighbour to punishment, but at the very least you'll enslave them to an unreality, won't you? Falsehood is unreality, isn't it? I mean, without the truth, a court is a farce. It's ludicrous. But does this mean that this commandment is only about courts and laws and oaths and so on, and that it doesn't apply anywhere else? No, of course not. To restrict this only to the courtroom would be very foolish. In Jesus' day, the Pharisees looked at the rules on making oaths and so on in the Old Testament and thought, well, it's really important that when you go into court and you make an oath and you swear on the Holy Bible and you say, so help me God, it's really important that in those cases you don't lie because you've made an oath before God. But outside the court, well, it's all fair game. You know, if I swear by something else, if I swear by heaven or by earth or by Jerusalem, then it doesn't matter so much if I break it, because it's not a solemn oath. It's not an oath made before God. But it's interesting. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus responds to this very thing, and he says, Matthew chapter 5, verse 34, he says, I tell you, do not swear at all, either by heaven, for it is God's throne, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. In other words, what does he do? He says, be very careful making any promise. Because if you make a promise by heaven, remember that it is God's throne. Heaven is God's throne. You make a promise by earth, remember that it is God's footstool. In other words, God is always before you. You're always standing in front of God, and therefore be very careful what you say. Let your yes be your yes and your no be your no. That is what Jesus is saying. You're always under oath. God is watching every idle word, Jesus says in another place, and will be asked to give an account for every idle word. You're always in the witness stand as far as God is concerned. You're always a witness. And therefore, just as your neighbour desperately needs the truth in a courtroom, or else they'll end up in slavery, so our neighbours out there desperately need the truth at all times, or else they'll end up in slavery. Slavery to unreality. Our society hangs on this. Human community hangs on this. Lewis Smeads puts it like this, and you've got the quote on the front of your sheet. He says, truthfulness is one more invisible fibre that holds people together in humane community. When we cannot assume that people communicating with us are truthful, we cannot live with them in trust that they will respect our right to freedom to respond to reality. If we cannot trust each other to respect this basic right, we have lost our chance to be human together in God's manner. In our age, when deceit threatens every area of our society, the last word must be, speak the truth, be the truth, for your truth sets others free. Whole societies unravel, don't they, when governments tell lies? When the government says you can trust our building codes when really you can't? Or you can trust our doctors when the reality is you can't trust them? Or you can trust our drinking water when the reality is you can't? You enslave people. You enslave people to an unreality, and it can destroy them, sometimes literally. You cannot have a human community built on lies and deception. Every time you and I break this commandment, we enslave somebody. And let's say, you know, you sell a house and you know full well that the house has a structural flaw in it, but you don't say anything about it. You just tell a lie, or you cover it over or something. What you're doing in that situation is you're depriving the buyer of the real cost of buying that house, the real cost of owning that house. And as a result, the buyer is totally out of touch with reality, and they're enslaved to this unreal world, this unreal expectation. And it's potentially devastating, especially if it's a big fault and especially if they can't afford it. Or if you have a good friend, totally different example. And outwardly, you relate to them one way, and you relate as if you're totally okay with the way that they live their life and totally okay with the decisions that they're making in their life, but inwardly you're actually quite worried, quite distressed, quite concerned, and maybe even angry, but you just don't go on, you don't say anything, you just let it go as if it's unnoticed. What you are doing is you are depriving your friend of the freedom that comes from self-awareness, aren't you? An awareness of how they can come across to other people, see? As long as you don't tell them the truth, or you pretend that everything is okay, they have no idea of the reality. And in both cases, you're advantaging yourself to terrible cost, a terrible cost to the other person. The seller lies about the structural flaw. Why? Because they want a better price, I guess. The friend lies to a friend because they don't want the hassle of having an awkward and difficult conversation. But either way, you enslave the other person to a false world. You're on the witness stand and your neighbour is suffering for lack of truth. Maybe your spouse is suffering for lack of truth. Maybe your friends are suffering for lack of truth. Your sons, your daughters, your parents. Every time we twist, every time we manipulate to our advantage, we deprive our neighbour of justice and freedom. Deceit is very destructive. That's why this is so important. Proverbs chapter 15, verse 4 says, "The tongue that brings healing is a tree of life, but a deceitful tongue crushes the spirit." And I take it that's why Jesus says, one of the reasons why Jesus says in Matthew chapter 12, "I tell you that men will have to give an account on judgment day for every careless word they have spoken." You and I are getting away with deceit against our neighbours all the time. All the time. But Jesus says you and I will need to give an account for every careless word. And as Christian people, we ought to care about truth, surely, because we live for a God of truth, a God who cannot lie and does not lie. The righteous hate what is false, says the book of Proverbs. Do you? Well, how are we going to follow this commandment? How are we going to follow this commandment? This is our last point. I hope by now in our series on the Ten Commandments you realise that there is no commandment you can sort of look at and say, you know, I'm okay with this one. You're not fine with this one. You're not fine with it at all. You might have trouble. I might have trouble keeping it between now and the time I get home tonight. So what hope is there? How can we become the kind of people that this world needs, who are truth bearers rather than bearers of falsehood? Well, what's the way that we normally motivate people to be honest? How do we motivate children to be honest in the classroom or our own children? How do we not motivate them to be honest? Well, normally we say something like, don't tell lies or you'll get caught. Or don't tell lies or it'll destroy your life. Or don't tell lies or God will punish you or something. Or don't tell lies because you don't want to be like those naughty children who tell lies. In other words, honesty pays. Practically, you'll be better off if you speak the truth. You'll have a better self-image if you speak the truth. People will think more highly of you. You may even be more successful if you tell the truth. And in a well-run world, that's what you'd expect, wouldn't it? That's what you'd expect that to be the case, wouldn't you? But the trouble is, of course, this isn't a well-run world. And sooner or later, you're going to find yourself in a situation where honesty doesn't pay. And this commandment is not saying, be truthful so long as it pays, so long as it's convenient. Be truthful so long as it suits you. Be truthful so long as you can see some benefit. It says, be truthful for the sake of your neighbour, which means I'm required to promote honesty even when it doesn't pay, even when it costs terribly, even when I might lose my reputation, or I might lose my friend, or I might lose my job, or I might lose my life. If the main way you train yourself to be honest is through the honesty pays method, if honesty doesn't pay, there's going to come a point, surely, when you're bound to lie, isn't there? Where you're going to cheat, you're going to twist, you're going to spin. So how are you going to become the kind of people who tell the truth no matter what, in every situation? That's what this command demands. How are you going to be people who liberate other people with the truth no matter what? And the answer is, I think, you've got to remember the preamble to the Ten Commandments, as we do with all the commandments. Remember the preamble? See, the Ten Commandments, they don't just start off, okay, well, here's number one, you shall have no other gods before me, do they? How do they start? It starts, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. It starts with a prologue, a preamble, a reminder of something. And it says, I am the Lord your God who with miraculous deeds and signs and wonders liberated you from slavery in Egypt. Therefore, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, number 9, because I liberated you, be the kind of people who go out and liberate others with the truth, do you see? It doesn't say tell the truth because it'll pay. It doesn't say tell the truth because God will answer your prayers. It says tell the truth, liberate your neighbours because God has liberated you. And Christian friends, let me ask you, if he has liberated the Israelites from Egypt, where has he liberated us? Right at the end of Jesus' life, he was on trial for his life. And as you may remember, there were all kinds of witnesses brought in, false witnesses, to testify against him. Classic kind of piece of breach of this commandment. And then eventually Jesus is brought before the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, and Pilate asks him a question. Are you a king? And right at that point, well, Jesus is put to test, isn't it? He's put to the test in relation to this very commandment. Because you see, if at that point Jesus tells the truth, if he says, yes, I am a king, he's dead. He plays right into their hands. That's exactly what they want him to say. That's exactly what they want him to say so that they can convict him and execute him. But what if he lies? What if he withholds the truth? What if he twists the truth just a little? And he says, I'm just a king for some, or I'm just a king for those who accept me. Well, I guess he lives. If he lies, he lives. But if he lies, we're lost, aren't we? Because what was his death all about? Why did he come to die? He came to die for our lies, didn't he? And at the cross, God tells the truth about our sin, the painful, unpleasant truth, when Jesus is punished in our place. So there is the ultimate test for Jesus. Either he lies to Pilate so that he's saved and we're lost, or he tells the truth so that we're saved at infinite cost to himself. Do you see? At that point, Jesus Christ is the ultimate witness in the ultimate courtroom. And if he doesn't tell the truth for the sake of his neighbours at infinite cost to himself, we're lost. So what does he do? He says to Pilate, John chapter 18, verse 37, "You are right in saying I am a king. In fact, for this reason I came into the world to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." What is truth? Pilate asked. And of course you know how the story ends. But do you see? This is the liberation. Because he passed that test gloriously, because of his truthfulness, because of his faithfulness unto death, Jesus Christ has liberated sinners not just from slavery to a foreign political power like Egypt, but from sin and death itself. And the only way you'll ever be the kind of person who can truly liberate others with the truth is if he has liberated you. Has he? Everyone on the side of truth listens to his words. But if he has, Christian friends, do you see what this command is saying to you and to me tonight? Since he has liberated you with the truth, now get out there and liberate others with the truth. What have you got to lose? You see, why do we tell lies? Normally it's because we're afraid of losing something, isn't it? Losing our reputation, losing face, losing a relationship, maybe losing our job. But Christian friends, you have been liberated from all of that. Here is a true saying, Paul says, that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners. What have you got to lose by telling the truth? Do you see the incentive? Okay, you might lose your job, you might lose your reputation, you might lose a friend, and that is sad. But you cannot lose Jesus Christ. Hell is a place where nobody tells the truth about anything. And sadly, so much of our world is a semi-hell, where far too few people tell the truth except when it is expedient and convenient to do so. And as a result, people are being harmed and exploited everywhere. But what's the opposite of that? Well, it's a community of human beings in which everybody tells the truth and where nobody spins and nobody exaggerates and nobody's misrepresenting. And people are transparent, and people are speaking the truth lovingly and gently and thoughtfully. And that's what we're called to be. A community like that in the middle of Sydney, which is hardly a place known for telling the truth. It'd be heaven to live in a community like that, wouldn't it? Well, we're not only called to be that community, but we're given the strength and the resources to do it. We've been liberated. Well, let's take it up and let's be that sort of community. Let's pray. We ask now, Father, for the sake of the truth, that you would give us the strength through the liberation that comes from the Lord Jesus, whose truthfulness, even in the face of death, set us free from sin and death. Please, Father, would you give us the strength to be truth bearers, even when it comes at great cost to us. We pray it for Jesus' sake. Amen.